Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Voting has ended in Greece's crucial referendum Sunday on the country's economic future that could determine whether Athens is ousted from the 19-nation euro currency bloc. Results are expected in the coming hours, but two exit polls of voters and three surveys conducted in the days leading up to the balloting all suggested that Greeks are narrowly rejecting the demands of the country's international lenders that Athens impose new austerity measures in exchange for more bailout loans. The Greek Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, called for a no vote, saying it would strengthen his government's hand in negotiating better bailout terms with its lenders. As Athens defaulted on a $1.8 billion loan payment due to the International Monetary Fund last week, European leaders said a negative vote would signal that Greece wants to leave the eurozone. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said over the past few days, genuine progress has been made in Vienna toward a nuclear deal with Iran. He spoke to the press on Sunday.
We have, in fact, made genuine progress. But I want to be absolutely clear with everybody. We are not yet where we need to be on several of the most difficult issues.
Foreign ministers from six negotiating powers are returning to Vienna and preparing to meet in a final push to secure a nuclear deal with Iran ahead of a self-imposed July 7th deadline. Military officials in Pakistan say a firefight with Islamist militants near the border with Afghanistan Sunday left four soldiers and 12 insurgents dead. The Army's media wing says fleeing terrorists also left behind three of their dead bodies. The fighting occurred in the Dadakhel area of North Waziristan. That's a semi-autonomous tribal region. This is VOA News. Tunisia is under a state of emergency Sunday, a week after a purported Islamic State terrorist massacred 38 people at a terrorist beach resort. The country's president went on national television Saturday to announce the declaration, saying Tunisia is facing a very serious danger for the next month. Police and the army will have special powers to carry out raids at any moment on the homes of suspected terrorists as well as other criminals. The Islamic State is claiming responsibility for the June 26th attack. East African regional heads of state plan to meet in Tanzania's commercial capital of Dar es Salaam on Monday to assess and find a way to resolve the crisis in Burundi. It's unclear if Burundi's president Pierre Nkurunziza would attend the meeting. It comes as he intensifies his campaign for a controversial bid to seek re-election. Burundi's opposition says Nkurunziza's third-term bid undermines the country's constitution. Iraqi Sunni political leaders are accusing the government of two bloody attacks on civilians in Anbar province in the past 24 hours. An Iraqi military spokesman denies those charges. Edward Uranian reports.
Iraqi media claims two government attacks in the past 24 hours have killed a large number of civilians in Anbar province's largest cities of Ramadi and Fallujah. Sunni leaders from Anbar province say dozens of civilians were killed and wounded in a government airstrike on a football stadium near Ramadi. Witnesses also accuse government forces of shelling parts of Anbar's second largest city, Fallujah, killing several dozen people. Other reports claim the government dropped barrel bombs over parts of the city. VOA could not independently confirm the allegation. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Pope Francis, the first South American pontiff, is returning to the continent Sunday to begin an eight-day visit to Ecuador, Bolivia, and Paraguay. The 78-year-old Jesuit Pope is skipping his native Argentina on the trip but plans to head to his homeland next year. It's his 19th trip abroad since assuming the papacy more than 2 years ago. As he left Rome, Francis said he wanted to emphasize the plight of impoverished people in the three countries he's visiting, especially children in need, the elderly, the sick, the imprisoned, the poor, and those who are victims of this throwaway culture. An unmanned Russian cargo vessel successfully docked with the International Space Station Sunday morning, breaking a string of failed attempts to resupply the station. The Progress delivered more than 3 tons of food, fuel, and supplies to the orbiting outpost. The U.S. astronaut Scott Kelly and the Russian cosmonauts are currently living and working on the ISS. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Specifically, they will just sit and discuss and assess the situation, including getting an updated version of what exactly is on the ground, what is happening.
East African regional leaders meet on Monday in Tanzania to assess and find a solution to the crisis in Burundi.
Here in South Africa, where I'm speaking from, there are 600 U.S. companies that have created 150,000 jobs. And those 600 companies, the output of those companies account for about 10% of the GDP of South Africa.
Two leading U.S. trade officials returned from a trip to Africa. We'll have details.
We should apologize to all those who helped us to reach this independence, internationally, nationally, in Africa, within ourselves. We are talking now. People are dying.
And religious leaders in South Sudan call on the two warring factions to make peace. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. African regional heads of state are expected to meet in the Tanzanian commercial capital Dar es Salaam on Monday to discuss the crisis in Burundi. This comes as President Pierre Nkurunziza intensifies his campaign in a controversial bid to seek re-election. Tanzanian presidential spokesperson Asa Mwambini told me that Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete would host the regional leaders in their effort to end the crisis in Burundi.
It is true that the President Jakaya Kikwete has invited the heads of state of EAC at the capacity of the chairperson of the African the East Africa community, discussing the standoff in Burundi.
So, what is going to be different about this EAC summit on Monday, especially when they've had quite a few of these meetings and the crisis seemed to be getting worse in Burundi?
Well, the situation getting worse in Burundi actually calls for more meetings than boycotting meetings of this nature. And specifically, they'll just sit and discuss and assess the situation, including getting an updated version of what exactly is on the ground, what is happening. How does this, the government of Burundi has either rejected or implemented the conditions that were set by the heads of state in their first meeting before coming up with a follow-up meeting a month ago?
Some people have called for a postponement of the presidential election scheduled for July 15. With the current situation on the ground, will the heads of state look into some of these matters or calls by some African leaders as well as the international community for this presidential election, for that matter, to be postponed?
Well, first, you must understand that it was within the mandate of the EAC heads of state that they mandated the government of Burundi to extend the elections within the mandate of the current regime of President Nkurunziza. And so, for sure, this would just definitely be one of the issues assessing whether, some of these, because this, the extension of the elections was part of the condition that was set by the heads of state. And they also mandated the Burundian government to ensure that not only extend the elections, but also make sure that Burundians who are afraid in Tanzania and Rwanda, return to participate in the democratic process that is taking place now. So definitely this will be part of the issue to assess whether the refugees and people who fled out of the country, are they really participating, and whether the extension was enough. Because I know for sure the Burundian government extended the elections, but whether it met the expectation of these heads of state, this would certainly be an issue to look at.
The question then becomes, what will be different from this meeting? Because the situation, as I said initially, seemed not to be improving. There is more violence. The opposition is boycotting the poll. And the heads of state
keep meeting to try to find solutions to the problem, yet the solutions appear not to be working on the ground.
The difference would certainly come from the discussion. So, I mean, we don't need to preempt what they would definitely see. These are the heads of state with wisdom, with advice, with people on the ground, with looking at the situation itself. So certainly let's remain very optimistic that something good will come out of their wisdom.
So what will the government of Tanzania tell the people of Burundi ahead of this meeting of heads of state and government on Monday?
Unfortunately, Tanzania President Kikwete is speaking as the chair of the East Africa community. So certainly the stand of the heads of state will certainly remain to be the stand of the Tanzania government.
Asa Mwambene is the Tanzanian government spokesman. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. A trade mission including two leading U.S. trade officials with the Obama administration has just returned from a trip to Africa. The trip to Mozambique, South Africa, and Kenya also included representatives from U.S. companies looking to invest in Africa. From Washington, I voiced this report written by VOA's William Eagle. Sub-Saharan Africa is home to six of the world's fastest-growing economies, and the continent itself is growing at over 4% per year. The U.S. government sees that as an opportunity for American companies to find trade partners that will create economic benefits and jobs. Representatives from 14 American companies got their chance in late June when they went to meet potential partners in three countries, Mozambique, South Africa, and Kenya. The companies chosen for the trip, including General Electric and Honeywell International, offer world-class products and services in three growing sectors of African economies, transportation, energy, and agricultural equipment. Leading the trade mission were two prominent members of the Obama administration, Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox and Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Global Market Arun Kumar. The trip was part of the Obama administration's campaign to promote U.S. exports, an investment called Doing Business in Africa. It offers U.S. companies opportunities to expand their reach in the global marketplace with African partners. Kumar says many American firms are not familiar with exporting beyond the Western Hemisphere.
We often find that there are a large number of U.S. companies that export to just one country, and that might be Canada or Mexico. But what we do find is that once they taste export success, we look beyond those borders and export to many more countries.
In a press meeting with African journalists, Kumar offered his views on the growing economic ties between the United States and Africa. He says that bilateral trade is essential for bringing new investment and technologies to Africa and creating jobs.
For instance, here in South Africa, where I'm speaking from, there are 600 U.S. companies that have created 150,000 jobs. And those 600 companies, the output of those companies account for about 10% of the GDP of South Africa. So that's a clear example of U.S. companies creating jobs. That's a clear example of how, as trade and investment grows, more jobs will be created. And these jobs are typically of a very high quality.
He says that's equally true of African companies like the South African energy and chemicals company Sasol, which invests in the United States.
Sasol is the biggest foreign direct investor in the state of Louisiana. And what is really interesting is that a number of companies from a number of countries, both in the developed and developing worlds, are now investing in the United States because they find that investing in the United States, A, gives them a really good return because the United States has a very good kind of business climate and a great market.
The U.S. Commerce Department official says many jobs, both in the U.S. and in Africa, rely on the ability to plug into global supply chains where many countries contribute various components to a finished product.
It is very difficult to build an entire product in one country and be competitive. It is very possible to build a component of a product and supply that globally and be competitive. So we encourage the integration of supply chains, and in particular, we're interested in integrating into those supply chains, small and medium enterprises.
In 2014, U.S. exports to sub-Saharan Africa reached a record $25.4 billion, an increase of over 5%. The U.S. government is working to improve on that number. In late July 24 to 26, President Obama will attend the 6th Global Entrepreneurial Summit in Nairobi, Kenya. It will bring together business leaders, mentors, and high-level government officials in an effort to show the U.S. government's support for innovation and economic development around the world. Last November, the Commerce Department introduced a number of small and medium enterprises to opportunities in Africa at a conference called Discover Global Markets. In September, a U.S. government program called Trade Winds will sponsor a business development conference in Johannesburg and a trade mission that will bring 70 U.S. companies to 8 countries in Africa. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington. Amid a surge of deadly violence by Boko Haram militants in Nigeria's northeast, the governor of the embattled Borno state is trying to assure residents of their safety. For VOA, Christine has more from the Senegalese capital, Dakar, with Karim Haruna in Zabamari, Nigeria.
Fighters from the Islamist militant group stormed the village of Zabamari on the outskirts of the Borno state capital, Maiduguri, Friday evening. The militants killed 7 people before being repelled by the military and vigilantes known as the civilian JTF. On a visit to the rice farming community on Saturday, State Governor Kashim Shettima commended the security forces.
If not because of the gallantry displayed by them and the civilian JTF, the casualty figure could have been much higher.
The attack comes as Boko Haram intensifies its campaign of bombings and shootings in Borno State, where the insurgency got its start in 2009. Last week, the militants shot dead 145 people in rural communities of Borno State and carried out a twin suicide bombing near Maiduguri that killed another 14. They also murdered 11 people they accused of deserting the group. The group's campaign to impose strict Islamic law on Nigeria's northeast has forced more than 1.5 million people from their homes and, according to the European Union, has left more than 20,000 dead. Many of the displaced have crowded into cities like Maiduguri, which are better protected from Boko Haram raids. Governor Shettima appealed to villagers of Zabamari not to flee, saying the military would protect them.
The people need not to relocate to any other community. We have more than enough internally displaced people to contend with.
The attacks increased the pressure on recently inaugurated President Muhammadu Buhari to fulfill his campaign promise to crush the insurgency. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
The Uganda 2016 election campaigns are underway with political parties in the process of electing their flag bearers. There's concern, however, that without meaningful electoral reforms, the elections may not meet the expectations of many, especially in the opposition. Charles Wanguya is the communications director of the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in the capital, Kampala, for an update on the fate of the electoral reforms as elections draw near.
What is happening now is that the Constitution Amendment Bill is still before a committee of parliament, which is still scrutinizing it. They have already gone through receiving opinions from members of the public, members of civil society organizations, members of opposition political parties have appeared before the committee. We do not know yet what kind of report will come out of the committee and when that report will be coming out. Of course, the concern is Parliament's time is very limited. A lot of members of Parliament are still struggling to secure their return to Parliament, and therefore, not just the work of that committee, but general parliamentary work is kind of slow.
Yeah, then in that case, given how the process works, is there a chance that there could be reforms and that would get implemented before the elections?
That's the biggest concern. Personally, I feel every time this country is going through an election, we most likely go through an election without application of the law that has just been made.
Some political parties are either in the process or about to elect their flag bearers for the 2016 elections. Where does this leave the reform process? Does it die? Because when their flag bearers, then that sets the process in motion.
I believe personally that the processes will go on concurrently, but how they will impact the actual election is a different matter. Political parties, as you rightly said, are busy preparing internal elections. A lot of them, needless to mention, have been mired with a lot of controversy, but that means that no matter what happens with the parliamentary process, with the process of passing electoral reform, that the parties are getting ready for an election next year. So the elections will go ahead. Parties are preparing for these elections. Whether they will be impacted by any reforms they've been demanding or not is a wait-and-see game.
There are some politicians and other leaders who feel so strongly about lack of electoral reforms who have said it's not good to boycott the elections, but it's better to make them not happen. What does that mean, and how would that help?
It's neither here nor there. I do not know if I can give you an answer that responds exactly to your inquiry. But yes, there is a lot of concern. There's been a lot of concern that without electoral reforms, the current legal regime under which elections are to be held is not sufficient. That's a very valid concern. It's been running for a long time. The other strand of the argument advanced by some activists and some members of the opposition has been there is no need to participate in an election where the legal regime and the environment cannot guarantee a free and fair process. The third strand has been, just as you said, that people think you don't boycott the election, so you continue to go and participate, but make the election not happen. This thinking is, in my view, hinged on the argument that what you can achieve is force a postponement of the election or make the environment unsustainable to hold a meaningful election. So you push the election forward, allow for a transition arrangement, and during that transition arrangement, you put in place such safeguards that will guarantee that the election will be free and fair. Now, this is what I think, that the regime in Kampala, the government in power, will not allow a postponement of the election. No matter what, it will go ahead toward the election as provided for under the current law. This is its own advantage. It's the advantage of its legitimacy. Whether the opposition parties and members of activist organizations are able to hold out and push for a transition arrangement is, in my view, most unlikely.
Charles Mwanguya is the communications director of the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. Religious leaders say despite the ongoing conflict, South Sudanese still have cause to celebrate the country's fourth independence anniversary. They say they are working together to urge the country's political leaders to make peace now. They are also urging them to apologize for dragging the country into a prolonged conflict. From the UE, Charlton Doki has the story from the capital, Juba.
Archbishop Daniel Dengbul is head of the Episcopal Church of Sudan.
For me, the fourth anniversary is very important. It is reminding us of the struggle that our people have done. They have struggled, they have died, and because of their life, because of their death, we received the independence of the Republic of South Sudan. Also, we need to congratulate the people of the Republic of South Sudan for the bold decision they made. They freed themselves and become a new nation.
Retired Bishop of Tarit Diocese, Bishop Emeritus Paride Taban, says he does not understand why South Sudanese must still suffer after they ended a long civil war with the government in Khartoum. Bishop Paride says South Sudan's leaders have let down not only their people, but also outsiders who helped end the war with Khartoum and supported the country's independence.
We should really apologize to each other for not being honest to one another. We should apologize to one another. We should apologize to all those who helped us to reach this independence, internationally, nationally, in Africa, within ourselves. We are talking now. People are dying in the bush.
Bishop Paride says instead of working for the good of the country, South Sudan's leaders have only caused more pain and suffering.
I'm saying to all South Sudanese, in the government, in the opposition part, we are all guilty. There's nobody who is not guilty. I've seen these days, even now in Wau, street boys eating rubbish in the garbage. We had no street children. What caused this? And sometimes in Juba or in the city, we are dancing, celebrating, and see the future of South Sudanese anguishing in the bush.
And Archbishop Bull says it's very important for politicians to stop inciting their supporters to carry out attacks or revenge attacks against rival communities.
And they don't see the incitement of communities, the incitement of a tribe, it will generate a very serious crime. So I am asking our politicians in the parliament or wherever they speak, they have to mind themselves of what they are saying. What they are saying is actually agitating that group you are representing, and that can put this country into a danger.
Bishop Paride says as the country celebrates the fourth independence anniversary, South Sudan's leaders should end the conflict and apologize to the millions of people affected by nearly 15 months of fighting.
Are we seeing these bones lying in the forest being finished by guns? And who is accountable for those children, for those men who have left widows and orphans behind? Who is going to apologize to the women and to the orphans of these people?
Bishop Paride says when South Sudan gained independence, most people expected to live in a democratic country where communities coexist peacefully. He says he is disappointed that only 4 years into South Sudan's independence, the country's leaders are importing weapons to kill fellow South Sudanese. Archbishop Bull says religious leaders are working together to reconcile communities torn apart by war.
And they don't see the incitement of communities, the incitement of a tribe. It will generate a very serious crime. So I am asking our politicians in the parliament or wherever they speak, they have to mind themselves of what they are saying. What they are saying is actually agitating that group you are representing, and that can put this country into a danger.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Meanwhile, Ugandan authorities are denying reports from South Sudan's rebels. They gunned down a Ugandan army helicopter in Kolo Kingdom. According to Brigadier General William Ezekiel, one Ugandan gunship was shot down on Sunday morning in Kodok, Upper Nile State, killing the entire crew. But the Uganda Air Force spokesperson, Captain Taboro Kichoncho, told my colleague Douglas Impuga that Uganda has not lost any plane.
That is a pure lie. We don't have any gunship in South Sudan. We are not involved with aiding in a military operation in South Sudan. We have no intentions at the moment to participate in such operations as air operations in that area. But this is not the first time those allegations have been out. Recently, like a month ago, 2 months ago, they have been circulating those reports, which reports are contrary to what we are doing here. I suspect and believe this is propaganda at play, and I can comfortably say those who are propagating such information, maybe they shut down a ghost or they shut down a different ghost, and I can perfectly say I wish them well for shooting down ghosts.
So no Ugandan gunship was shot down and no casualties were incurred?
Perfectly.
This is the second time, at least to my knowledge, that they have claimed having shot down one of your planes. Why do you think they're aiming to do this?
I think there has been a deliberate attempt to drag us into the conflict in South Sudan, and most importantly, to insinuate that we are actively carrying out air operations, and as well to bring us into what I may call their confusion. It's true we have our personnel on the ground, but as Air Force, there is no Air Force personnel operating in South Sudan at the moment.
Are Ugandan forces in the Upper Nile State?
No, we don't have them there. They are just chains. You know those areas we have been in for quite some time. They are the very areas we have our mission and operation, and we are supporting the Sudanese South Sudan government. We are not in Nile State. We are not in any state. We are not in those areas which are contested.
That was Ugandan Air Force spokesperson Captain Taboro Kichoncho. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Kampala.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Ademi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Ademi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, July 5th. Nigeria has fired Steven Keshi as head coach of the country's national team, the Super Eagles. The Nigeria Football Federation, NFF, announced Keshi's sack in a statement late on Saturday. The NFF said Keshi lacked the required commitment to achieve the Federation's objectives as set out in the coach's contract. The Federation had set up a committee to investigate Keshi after it emerged that he applied to coach the national team of Ivory Coast. The coach denies applying for the job, even though his name was among those seeking to coach the Elephants, as the Ivorian national team is known. In the interim, former Super Eagles coach Shaibu Amadu will take charge of the Super Eagles. Keshi led Nigeria to win the Africa Cup of Nations in 2013 in South Africa. He also qualified the Super Eagles for the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, where the team was eliminated in the second round. The NFF said it will name a substantive replacement for Keshi in due course. I spoke with two Nigerian sports analysts, Vincent Tubi and Tony Nezian, on the sack of Keshi. First is Vincent Tubi.
I think he deserves it because of the divided loyalty. He was, he's been trying to join either Cote d'Ivoire or one of these West African countries. So he's not been concentrating on his job.
Next is Tony Nezia.
The man now played into the hands of the people who did not want him, and perhaps may have applied, or maybe somebody else, you know, applied on his behalf to take over the job in that kind of position of the chief coach of the Elephants of Cote d'Ivoire.
I also asked the two sports analysts whether they think Nigeria should hire a foreign or Nigerian coach to replace Keshi. Here again is Vincent Tubi.
I think the list of local coaches, you know, is now exhausted because I think the problem with our local coaches is that of training. They have to be trained and trained and retrained to catch up with foreign coaches. And on the scale of balance, I think we have done better with foreign coaches than local coaches.
Again, Tony Nezia.
I believe that if they have to be decisive, they should try as much as possible to take that decision quickly.
You've been listening to Nigerian sports analyst Vincent Tubi and Tony Nezia commenting on the sack of Nigeria's head coach, Steven Keshi. Away from Keshi's sack now, Zimbabwe, Lesotho, Zambia, Mozambique, and Angola have advanced to the first round of the qualifying series for the 2016 African Nations Championship. The countries reached the final qualifying stage for countries in the Southern Zone following the return leg preliminary round matches played this weekend. The final qualifier from the preliminary stage in the zone will be determined today, Sunday, when South Africa takes on Mauritius. Meanwhile, in the qualifiers from the Central East Zone, Uganda, Burundi, and Ethiopia have reached the first round to be played on home and away basis in October. And in the Zone West A, Senegal and Mauritania have advanced to the first round on the same identical 4-1 aggregate. Mauritania advanced at the expense of Sierra Leone, while Senegal defeated Gambia to progress. The qualifiers have been played in three other zones: Northern Zone, Zone West B, and Central Zone. Overall, 15 teams will qualify from the six zones to join host Rwanda in the finals next year. Finally, the World Boxing Organization, WBO, may strip American boxer Floyd Mayweather of his WBO welterweight title on Monday. Mayweather has ignored a deadline by the WBO to give up his WBA and WBC junior middleweight titles. The WBO agreed to give Mayweather until June 1st to formally announce his intentions regarding the WBO belt. However, Mayweather appears to have ignored the second deadline of July 3rd and has not responded to the WBO. The WBO Championship Committee is expected to meet on Monday, where it will most likely vote to strip Mayweather of his belt. If Mayweather is stripped of the title, Timothy Bradley, who won the vacant interim title against Jesse Vargas last month, will be named the WBO welterweight champion. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Well, it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
I don't change my name to Godwin. I no more, I don't buy more to Godwin. They say my market no go sell, Godwin. And then we say I no go blue, Godwin. Then my brother, may them try their luck, my Godwin. Oh my Godwin, oh my Godwin, no. Don't pass exam, na God you win. And then me say you no go pass, for God you win. You wake up, see two day last song, na God you win. Robbers, they rob, they no see you, brother. They no see you, my sister. Oh, yeah, better pass. Na God you win, no, na God you win. Your wedding day, na God you win. And you don't tell where you dey find, but God you win. See, we go pop champagne today, God you win. Oh, we go dey dance, 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 cause God you win. Oh, lelele, anything you win, na God you win. And if you win election, my brother, God you win. Like if you win the contract, my friend, na God you win. And if you check the countdown, my brother, God you win. And if your market say lelele, na God you win. Why you no go dance? Na God you win. No na God you win. No na God you win. No. God you win.
Na so na so na so. He's daddy, yeah.
Yeah. And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Now that President Buhari has taken over the reins of government in Nigeria, he is confronting serious economic and security challenges. He has, of course, taken steps to move the military headquarters from Abuja to Maiduguri. He has also attended meetings of neighboring countries and have worked with them the setting up of a regional command center with a Nigerian at the head. But we have also heard from his assistants that they have discovered the kitty was empty when they took over the government. And quite surprisingly, they have appealed to those former officials to return money they have taken away, all the time insisting that the Buhari government will not enter into a witch hunt against the departing government. But the problem is far more than that now, because Boko Haram, faced with the strategy of the Buhari government, has now adopted a more dangerous position. It has now, it would seem, adopted the guerrilla terrorist mode. Every day now, we are hearing of hundreds of Nigerians being killed in the field, and no one knows what the end would be. We have not heard so much about even bringing about the girls that were captured. And in the circumstances, many Nigerians are beginning to wonder or to express concern that their ambitions for electing General Buhari is not being fulfilled. But terrorism really is not only related to Nigeria, and Africans should wake up and see the reality. In previous commentaries, we have mentioned terrorism in Kenya, in Uganda, and of course in Somalia. And most surprising of all is what happened last week in Egypt. For decades, Egypt has been a very stable society. But today, there is a threat of terrorism. Following the ousting of Morsi's government by the military, elements of the Muslim Brotherhood began to attack military outposts in the Sinai, which is not well inhabited. Then they moved to Cairo and they attacked the policemen. But last week we found a man, the prosecutor, being killed in one of the plushest areas of Cairo, Heliopolis. And this had made many Egyptians nervous. So I think Africans as a whole should be concerned about how they tackled terrorism. They do not have to wait until Boko Haram demonstrates it as a global reach. They must act now. Let's just take as an example what happened also last week when 30 British tourists were killed in Tunisia. All of Europe was frightened. Flags were being flown half-mast all over the United Kingdom, even mini silence in Wimbledon. Yet, triple that number of 30 Africans are being killed every day by terrorist group in Africa. And who are flying flags for those Africans? So I think the African Union has a responsibility. In America, there is now a slogan, Black Lives Matters. The time has come for the AU to say clearly, African life matters too. I thank you.
Thank you very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when the roots of a tree begin to decay, it spreads death to the branches. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Each year, the U.S. State Department sends Congress detailed reports assessing respect for human rights around the world. They evaluate how governments show respect for human dignity and individual freedoms, and they help shape our nation's foreign policies. The reports also signal to human rights defenders and activists under siege that the U.S. recognizes their struggle and stands with them. For far too many people, 2014 was defined by suffering and abuse perpetrated by terrorist groups like Boko Haram that exploit religious discourse and divisions to advance their destructive ideology. Meanwhile, governments in China, Egypt, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Iran, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and others continue to stifle a free press and the development of civil society by jailing journalists, bloggers, and nonviolent critics. As in previous years, the 2014 report on the state of human rights in Nigeria remains concerning. Last year, Boko Haram conducted many attacks on government and civilian targets throughout the country. It caused thousands of deaths and injuries, widespread destruction, internal displacement of citizens, and the flight of more than 100,000 refugees abroad. Responding to the group's terror campaign, and at times to crime in general, security services perpetrated extrajudicial killings and engaged in torture, rape, arbitrary detention, mistreatment of detainees, and destruction of property. The country also suffered from widespread societal violence, including ethnic, regional, and religious attacks. Other serious human rights problems included vigilante killings, prolonged pretrial detention, denial of fair public trial, government influence on the judiciary, infringement on citizens' privacy rights, restrictions on the freedoms of speech, press, assembly, religion, and movement, and official corruption. Impunity remained widespread at all levels of government. The government brought few individuals to justice for abuses and corruption, and authorities did not investigate the majority of cases of police or military abuse or punish perpetrators. There is no self-importance or arrogance in preparing this and other reports. We in the United States have seen our own share of racial discord and unrest recently, so we approach this with great self-awareness. But we also understand that with regard for human rights, every country, including our own, has room to improve. We're committed to advancing universal rights, building partnerships that will move us forward, and helping every man, woman, and child live up to their potential. And in cases like Nigeria, we are also committed to speaking out for those unable to do so themselves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.